In John Lanchester's new novel, The Wall, a young man embarks on 2 years of mandatory military service as a defender in a dystopian world. After a disaster known as The Change reshapes the globe's geopolitics, Joseph Kavanaugh, bespectacled, aimless, but ambitious, must spend 12 hours every day on the wall, a massive concrete edifice ringing the entire coastline. The wall serves to protect its citizens from the enemies, known only as the Others, who attempt to infiltrate its borders. John Lanchester is the author of 5 novels, including the best-selling Debt to Pleasure and Capital. The new novel is The Wall, and it's a great pleasure to welcome John Lanchester to the roundtable this morning. John, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Joe.
What brought you to want to write this particular story?
Well, in a way, I didn't. I was trying to write another novel. I was part of the way through a different novel. In fact, I still am exactly at the same point I was through that book. But I started having this recurring dream over a series of nights about a man standing guard on his own on a wall in the cold, in the dark, with the water lapping on the other side of the barrier. And I had it over a series of nights, and I started to wonder, you know, who is he? What is this? And then realized that actually that was the wrong question, that the right question was, what world is that? Because it felt like an altered world, felt different from the daily reality now. And I realized that it was, what I was imagining was a world after catastrophic climate change. And that sort of stayed with me. And I started thinking about, well, what would that world be like? What would the texture of life be like in it? What would life be like for the people in it? And in a sense, the book was a really unraveling that image and that moment of, you know, thinking about what that other world is. And the story is a sort of takes the character, Joseph Kavanaugh, through the world. It's kind of unfolding and unwrapping or unpacking of that central image that literally came to me in a dream. It's never happened to me before, and I don't expect it ever to happen to me again. But the sequence was dream, image, character, world, story.
Did you ever expect or think that in your writing career that you would write dystopian fiction?
No, and I'm perfectly happy for it to be called that. I don't disavow it at all as a description. It wasn't in my head while I was writing it, because in a sense, in my mind, it was almost more like nonfiction, in the sense I was accepting one premise, one big premise about this world irrevocably altered by, you know, about 4 degrees Celsius, 8 to 9 degrees centigrade of global warming. That was like the given thing of the book for me. And then the rest of it, when I say it was like nonfiction, it was almost that I was trying to imagine all the consequences, you know, if this, then that, and what would that be like, and what would change about the other thing. And, you know, in a sense, possibly, it's something slightly scarier than dystopian fiction. It's sort of almost closer, maybe, to a form of dystopian non-fiction, or fiction fiction that unwraps and unpacks a non-fiction premise.
Well, it certainly seems that way. I mean, obviously, every day we are greeted with stories. In this book, a massive edifice is along the coastline, and it's serving to protect its citizens from enemies known as the Others. That's pretty much what we read about when we're talking about our Mexican border.
Unfortunately, it is. I mean, Trump hadn't started talking about the war when I began writing the book. It was early 2016, and, you know, I would have confidently gone out and put the cash value of my house on betting against Trump being the Republican nominee, let alone the future president.
Right.
But that trend in our society, the sort of turning inward and the turning away from each other and the putting up of barriers and fortifications and a kind of a widespread, because it's not just in the United States or the UK, I mean, it is really all across the world, this sense of, you know, walls and fortifications and barriers going up and people turning in on, societies turning in on themselves. That was very much a strand that was in my head at the beginning of the book and, you know, unfortunately has only got worse.
It does seem, as you mentioned, that the catalyst for much of this, the catalyst of your telling the story, was a concern over what was happening to our planet in regards to the climate. That would be the thing that would push us to what you refer to as the change.
Yes, that is the main thing, the main kind of premise or given of the book. was I thought of it in terms of a dotted line, you know, that thing lines you have in graphs, you have a solid line coming up to the present and then a dotted line stretching into the future. And I was thinking about us continuing to travel along that dotted line in respect of the climate and the kind of gloomier scenarios that the scientists come out with about, you know, well, with several degrees of warming happening quite quickly if we don't change the way we live and if things happen, you know, faster rather than slower. And that was definitely the trend I was projecting forward. And the other kind of dotted line I was stretching into the future was this one about our society and politics and the kind of that moment of, you know, pull up the drawbridge and, you know, turn in on ourselves.
In the book, we read about Joseph Kavanaugh. He has to spend 12 hours of every day on the wall. Tell us a little bit about this man and his backstory.
In this altered world, it's set in an island nation in the North Atlantic. It's a kind of altered version of Britain. And there's a concrete fortification all the way around the coastline, all 6,000 miles, 10,000 kilometers of it, 15-foot high concrete wall. And every citizen of the country has to spend 2 years serving a tour of duty. It's a form of national service or military service. They spend 2 years standing on the wall, guarding it against the others, which is what they, as you say, they call the desperate people fleeing the now inhabitable parts of the globe that are in, you know, southern latitudes, closer to the equator. And as the book starts, Kavanaugh is starting his first day of his two-year tour on the wall. And on the wall, there's this very simple and very brutal premise that you do a two-year turn of duty, 2 weeks on, 2 weeks off, 12 hours at a time. And if one of the others gets over the wall on your watch when you're on duty, you are put out to sea. You're kicked out of the country, put out to sea, and you become an other yourself.
And there also are the defenders who ultimately serve alongside Kavanaugh.
Yep, no, he's one of a group. As I say, it's a sort of national service, which is a it's a condition of citizenship. It's what everyone who belongs in this country does. And it's clear that the wall. Obviously, it's a huge physical fact about life in this country, but it's also a metaphorical thing that divides the world. Really, there's two categories: there's us and there's them. And you know, there is this sort of brutal clarity and simplicity about their mental categories. You know, you're either us or you're another. And the defenders with whom Kavanaugh serves, and whom he gradually changes. He's a sort of ambitious, sort of fairly solitary young man at the start, and he gradually realizes he has more in common with the defenders around him. And then various things happen in the course of the book. Don't want to give too much away, but various things that happen that kind of alter his perspective very profoundly. And has a series of don't want to call them adventures, but you know, a lot happens to him, and he ends up seeing the world very differently.
I do want to mention for listeners the book. We've been talking about very heavy stuff over the last several minutes, but the book is very witty. It's very funny.
Well, thank you for saying so. I mean, I think one of the things about, if you're thinking about a sort of dystopian world, one of the things that happens in it is people don't wander around saying, "Wow, I'm feeling really dystopian today. How about you? Are you feeling really dystopian too?" They say, "Yeah, no, I'm super dystopian." Yeah, that's not what it's like. And the thing I thought was that if you look at that map of the world with several degrees of warming, it is, you know, difficult to imagine what life would be like. But it would be something like the order of change, the scale of change, the magnitude of change. It's something like living through a world war, except this time with the enemy of the climate instead of another, you know, another block. And the thing about, you know, living through a world war, as our parents and grandparents, many of us did, is that, you know, life is unimaginably altered in many respects, but also life goes on too, you know. People have jokes, people fall in and out of love, you know, people complain about what they had for breakfast. There is a sort of dailiness to life, even in really extreme circumstances. And I wanted to have that feeling in the book, because in a way you need, if you're describing a very different world, you need a balance between things that are very different and things that are familiar in order to, for the reader to be able to sort of relate to it and identify it and for it to seem real. Because it's just, if every single aspect of human life, including how people think and feel and behave, is fundamentally, radically altered, then actually, in a sense, it's quite hard to feel that speaks to you. You need a balance between the otherness and the familiarity.
It seems that for most of us, we know that if you take our temperature, and I'll use degrees, it's 98.6. And that is, if you are that, you are not sick, you are normal. But if you are 99.6, you're sick. It shows us just how fragile we are as human beings. And what's fascinating to me about the book is just how fragile the planet then becomes of that warming, and that it's not major. And of course, this is what climate science has been screaming to us about for now decades, that it doesn't take much to bring us to that change that you write about.
I think it's very hard to get our heads around that. You know, I think one of the difficulties of climate change as a subject is the thing that the French aphorist La Rochefoucauld said, death, like the sun, cannot be contemplated directly. In other words, you can't look straight at it. I think something like that is true about climate change. It's hard to face. It's hard to face this prospect of a completely altered planet, really, just being changed by our actions, changed by, you know, emissions, and just, what sound like a very small numbers of degrees of warming, fundamentally reshaping the planet and reshaping human civilization. That is a very, very difficult thing to look in the eye. And one of the things I think I was hoping to do was to make it thinkable, you know, because really it's clear that we need action on this, but just yelling at people seems not to work. We need other ways of making it thinkable and imaginable. And by making it imaginable, we can give us a reason to make it stop. You know, I'm trying to prevent the future I imagine from happening.
And with that said, did you want to leave us thinking, or did you want to leave us hopeful?
Bit of both. I think hope is actually indispensable. I think we can't afford despair. And I think one of the things about the climate story is that it can seem so big, so overwhelming, so planetary, and the scale of our own actions can seem so trivial that it actually becomes an invitation to despair and to inaction. You know, nothing we can do. And so hope is actually really important. Hope is not just politically important. It's a matter of, you know, we need hope for survival. And by the way, the science supports that. You know, the science talks about the fact that we can keep the world to 1.5 degrees centigrade of warming. And, you know, that's a vastly different world, even from an extra half a degree centigrade. The difference between 1.5 and 2 degrees, according to the UN, is hundreds of millions of lives saved from negative impacts of all sorts. You know, and every tenth of a degree matters. So that hope is really, really important, because hope is the basis on which we'll act. But some of the news is so grim and so dark, it's actually an incentive to despair. So I was really hoping that by, you know, imagining it differently, not in terms of news headlines, but in terms of a story, that might land differently with readers, might give people a different set of motives.
The book is really a thrilling read and a lot of fun. It is called The Wall, a novel. It is published by Norton. John Lanchester, what a pleasure to speak with you this morning. I thank you very much for sharing with us.
Thank you very much for having me, Jay.
Great pleasure. Thank you. Again, The Wall, a novel, is by John Lanchester. It is published by Norton. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.